This is a session about congenital porter systemic shunts. I'm going to be grilling our two clinicians at Paragon, so Adam Bell and Mickey Tivers. I'm going to be directing some questions at them and seeing what they think, get their thoughts. So, Adam, if you're going to kick us off, can you tell us what kind of conditions can cause or be associated with porter systemic shunts? Particularly, we're talking about canine shunts.
Love it. I can certainly try. So I think a shunt is obviously a connection between, or an abnormal connection between the portal vasculature, portal vein, and some part of the systemic circulation. So I think most of us, when we think about shunts, the first thing we think about are the congenital shunts, but there are also acquired shunts too. The congenital shunts, for the most part, obviously the animal's born with them, so there's some kind of either persistence of the appropriate physiological connection between those circulations in utero and a failure of it to adapt to the changes postpartum, or because perhaps the liver can't cope with the increased blood flow postpartum, a pressure relief valve essentially, a part of the circulation that opens up to prevent portal hypertension. So with the congenital shunts, those perhaps the more common ones we think about, they may be intrahepatic, they may be directly between the portal and systemic venous system within the liver parenchyma, or they may be extrahepatic, so outside of the liver, and they can be between the portal vein itself or any of its tributaries and pretty much any part of the venous circulation. But perhaps the classic one is the splenocaval shunt, so from the splenic to the vena cava. That's perhaps one of the more common ones we find on ultrasound and CT. There can also be issues where the shunt develops because the portal circulation within the liver itself is inadequate, doesn't develop properly. So microscopic issues within the liver and hyperplasia of the portal vein itself. If it's too small, if it doesn't develop appropriately, then it can't cope with the increased blood flow. And then a shunt will open up to prevent essentially fatal portal hypertension. I think more rarely we can see connections between the hepatic arterial and venous circulation as well, so arteriovenous malformations. But I think the extra-intrahepatic large single shunts are perhaps the most common thing that we see. But you can also be born without a shunt and develop one later in life. And in that case, again, as a way of reducing portal hypertension, most commonly they're associated with some kind of diffuse liver disease. So cirrhosis, chronic hepatitis, perhaps even neoplasia.
Great, thanks for that, Adam. And on to Mickey. What are the most common congenital porter systemic shunts?
Well, I think probably we see the extrahepatic congenital porter systemic shunts most commonly, and we certainly see them mostly in small breed dogs, terrier breeds, and they've been shown to be hereditary in Yorkshire Terriers and Cairn Terriers. Also, I think we recognise certain breeds like Westies seem to be predisposed. Less commonly, we will see the intrahepatic form of the shunts, and again, certain breeds are predisposed, and these are generally large breed dogs, so and Labradors and Irish Wolfhounds are the sort of the common ones, Australian cattle dogs as well, although I suppose that's probably less of a concern for us unless we go and work in Australia. But I think it's worth remembering that sometimes we do see extrahepatic shunts in larger breed dogs. So just as a Labrador, the shunt doesn't necessarily mean it's intrahepatic. And probably very less occasionally, if that's the appropriate term, we may see intrahepatics in small breed dogs as well.
Okay, and what do you
think? Your question?
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does, indeed. And what, with you being the surgeon in the room, what about the anatomy of the shunts? Does that have an impact on the severity of clinical signs?
Well, I think inevitably, it's a really interesting question. I think one of the things that's always interesting and puzzling about these dogs is that some animals are extremely severely affected with their shunt, or the signs of shunting are very severe, and others are relatively mildly affected. And I'm sure most of us, even in practice, have occasionally picked up a shunt in a dog which has sort of seemingly been normal, perhaps as a health check in an older animal. But certainly we recognise that there's not necessarily a particularly great correlation between the precise morphology of the shunt and the clinical signs. But clearly, you know, intuitively, if we've got more shunting or more blood bypass in the liver, then we'd expect more severe signs. So if we've got a very, potentially got a large shunt, then that may allow more blood to bypass the liver. Although curiously, I don't think that's always the case. I suppose its flow is quite complex and it may be related to the speed or volume of flow rather than necessarily just the size of the shunt. There's also some curious variations based on the anatomy. So there's it suggests, so Adam mentioned obviously there's different types of shunt, and we can categorize them based on where they insert on the systemic vasculature. And yet commonly we think of the classically the shunt inserting on the vena cava, but we also will see them inserting on the azygous vein or the phrenic vein. And it's suggested that animals that have a shunt inserting on their phrenic or azygous vein may have less severe signs because essentially have, because the shunt is very close to the diaphragm, when during normal respiration, we may actually have intermittent occlusion of the shunt during the day-to-day life. So ultimately they may have less shunting overall. And certainly I think sometimes we do see older animals with portozygous or portophrenic shunts, which have been picked up perhaps with fewer or less severe clinical signs.
Very interesting. I didn't know that about the diaphragm and respiration. Interesting.
I don't think it's proven, but it's certainly suggested, and it makes some physiological sense.
Absolutely. Adam, what kind of typical signs do you see with these dogs that are presenting with congenital portosystemic shunt?
I think they're interesting, going along with what Mickey just said as well. I guess that there are some typical signs and some textbook signs, but they are inherently amazingly variable. And like you say, sometimes you go and you find a dog with an absolutely enormous shunt and apparently minimal clinical signs and vice versa. But the most common signs that the things we're looking for, I guess, primarily would be signs of hepatic encephalopathy, so malfunctioning of the brain as a result of the toxins and waste products that are not being eliminated and dealt with by the liver. So those can range from just being a little less responsive or vacant at times, or conversely hyperactive, particularly after feeding. That's the classic textbook thing. But I think variable or excessive responses, either up or down. They can maybe ataxic, they can circle, they can show blindness. In severe cases, they can show seizures, but often they are, owners, in my experience, owners just report that the animal seems a bit depressed, a bit less interested in interacting with them periodically, not necessarily consistently. So CNS signs, I think, are key. GI signs, not at all unusual. Could be associated with hypertension, portal hypertension, I guess, but I think commonly a part of the dysfunction of the whole GI system. So vomiting, diarrhea, anorexia or hyperexia, again, could be periodic. Melena, if there's GI bleeding. And I think it's worth remembering that if you do get those signs of GI upset, particularly the bleeding, that may exacerbate the hepatic encephalopathy. And then there are urinary signs. So they are dogs with shunts, whether acquired or congenital, are prone to forming ammonium urate crystals and stones, so signs of lower urinary tract disease, hematuria, stranguria, polyuria, all those sorts of things can certainly happen. Occasional urethral obstruction, and along the same lines of those, that very varied presentation, I've certainly seen a dog that we removed bladder stones from, is referred for cystotomy and bladder stone removal. And when the stones were analysed, they turned out to be ammonium urate, and then we went back again and had a look and indeed found a big, quite what appeared to be quite a large single extrahepatic shunt, but the dog was 7 or 8 years old and hadn't shown any previous signs, was quite fat in fact. So I think they're quite variable. Those, I think, are the main systems, the CNS, GI and urinary.
Great. And Mickey, have you got any tips for some of the sort of atypical signs, the ones that you can miss sometimes?
Well, I think Adam's right in the sense that they can sort of almost manifest any clinical sign they want. And to me, sometimes it doesn't entirely make sense quite what's going on. I mean, I don't think we really know why they have GI signs of vomiting and diarrhea necessarily. I think the classic is the small, stunted, runty puppy. The owners acquire because it's cute and then obviously regret it financially. But yes, but I think it is hard because, you know, the sort of syndrome of the older dog that perhaps has been normal, but these animals are probably never normal. And so you know, actually appreciating whether there's a problem in animals that maybe are slightly less severely affected, maybe quite challenging. So I suppose that's the thing I'm sort of thinking is quite interesting, is that essentially how do you detect clinical signs in an animal that actually probably doesn't really have overt clinical signs. Other things that I think Adam's pretty much covered it. I think cats, when we're talking about cats, cats have this sort of thing where they have a lot of drooling, tirelessness. And again, I've never been entirely certain whether that's GI or CNS or something else. And cats also will have copper coloured irises, which is very characteristic of a shunt. But again, I'm not clear on why that actually happens. It's probably some sort of pleiotropic gene thing. Yes, and the textbooks will talk about them having other congenital diseases, particularly being cryptorchid or umbilical hernias. Although I don't think I see that a great deal in the animals that I see.
Yeah, again, it could be one of those sort of textbook things that isn't actually there in practice.
You mentioned pica. I think that certainly can be. I mean, you see pica for a variety of reasons, obviously, but it might be a clue in some animals. But coming back to what Mickey said, I think he's absolutely right. With the more subtle changes, people don't realise it's a problem until perhaps it's identified and you treat them. They suddenly realise what they've been missing. The dog suddenly brightens up and starts playing and starts behaving normally and wants to go for walks, whereas the previously assumed it was just a bit sort of bit lazy and a bit quiet. So it can be very difficult to think about.
Of course, the trouble is then if you identify it with when the clinical signs are mild or perhaps apparently non-existent, then actually deciding on how to treat that animal can be quite challenging.
That makes me think of a case recently you had, Mickey, actually, with them, and it was an intrapatic shunt that you operated on, and I think the owner's remarks afterwards were they would like the dog to calm down a bit and become a little bit more quiet.
They said that the exact words were, where have you put the other battery? which is a bit strange. But I do remember one dog where we corrected its shunt, and then the owner was actually unhappy because she didn't like the new dog. It was too lively. I think she actually, it was a young Labrador, and she actually didn't like it. It was too much for her. Which is a bit of a shame. It just goes to show you can't please all of the people.
Okay, Adam, I'm going to throw this at you, being the medic in the room. What would be your emergency treatment of a dog with a shunt who presents with signs of hepatic encephalopathy?
So I think one of the things you want to do early on, while you're getting all the IV fluids and so on set up, I guess, but it's certainly to look for any evidence of and speak to the owners about anything that might have precipitated a problem. So any new factor, GI upset, skin infection, UTI, particularly infectious diseases where there's an increase in inflammatory mediators and wastes and so on circulating that could have exacerbated things. And you may, if you can identify anything of that sort, you want to try to treat that to then reduce its effect. Certainly, you can assume they're going to be dehydrated or hypovolemic, and even if clinically they seem okay, it's a reasonable working assumption to treat them as if they're 5% dehydrated, because that's difficult to pick up less than 5%. And we know that HE can certainly be exacerbated by dehydration and also by hyperkalemia. So assessing electrolytes early on is important, and dealing and managing any deficits that you identify. And glucose level 2, insufficiency, the animal may well be hypoglycemic, particularly if it's been poorly and not eaten for a while. So appropriately treating any hypoglycemia will alleviate some of the encephalopathic HE signs. So we're looking for fluid therapy, we're looking for attention to electrolytes, glucose, that kind of thing, and any underlying diseases that can be treated. Acidosis can also exacerbate HE. If you can assess acid base, that's great. There's a fair chance that it will improve as you manage the animal generally and improve its physiological status. So you may not need to do anything specific about it, it's just something to know about. And fairly obviously, particularly if the animal is comatose or semi-comatose, collapsed, then we're going to be wanting to give parenteral medication, not oral, until the animal is able to swallow and you're fairly confident it's safe and it's not going to aspirate. In terms of medical treatment, we don't have a huge amount of data to prove efficacy, but I guess what we'll often do is use an enema. Lactulose enemas, retention enemas, are an option, so a 50-50 lactulose and saline or water mix instilled into the colon and left for 20 minutes perhaps. And you could just hold the bum shut, or you could use a Foley potentially. But actually using just a normal warm water enema and cleaning out the large bowel may be beneficial. If the animal's seizuring, then phenobarbital is a reasonable choice, and I guess levetiracetam as well, potentially. If there's severe GI signs, particularly vomiting or signs of GI bleeding, then acid blockade may be appropriate, maybe omeprazole, for example. The question of the use of antibiotics is an interesting one, because that's certainly been called into question more recently, and I believe it's not generally used in human medicine. I think many of us still tend to want to give something just even if it makes us feel better. So metronidazole and ampicillin or amoxicillin are the classics to use intravenously. As I say, there is some question over there, the evidence for them. But if you can rehydrate and address the sort of physiological imbalances and so on, and the animal starts to improve, then the key next step really is to avoid animal-based proteins once they're eating, and that, I guess, takes us on to the more general management as well.
Mm. Yeah, go for it. So tell us, cases that aren't in hepatic encephalopathic states, how would you manage them medically?
So the dogs that don't have HE, the classic triad has always been diet, lactulose, and antibiotics. But as you said, there is some question over whether the antibiotics are appropriate at the moment. But certainly diet is a key thing. It needs to be very digestible, it needs to be fed to the requirements of the animal, but not overdone, particularly in terms of protein, which is going to exacerbate HE. And ideally, a vegetable protein source or potentially dairy source is better than animal protein. So, I don't know whether this acts as a swing on the BBC, so it's not an advert, but we tend to recommend Purina HA, which is soy-based, that seems to work very, very well. And appropriately, it can also be fed for growth, because obviously a lot of these animals, if they are congenital shunts, they're going to be quite young, they're still growing. So we need to be able to manage that. You can add things like cottage cheese to improve the protein levels if necessary. And I think feeding little and often as well is an important part of that. So a highly digestible, non-animal protein-based diet is appropriate. And lactulose seems to have a lot of helpful effects. It may just improve or reduce, I should say, the transit time and shift material through more rapidly. It seems to help to bind ammonium and bacterial numbers and remove those from the GI tract to reduce the amount of waste they're producing. I think the reading there was suggesting it might alter the balance of bugs in the gut. Well, that's true, I'm not 100% sure. But I think certainly oral lactulose two or three times a day. And really, it's there's really a dose you give enough to make the stools soft but not too loose, and that's variable between individuals, I think. So diet and lactulose are the key, and then I must admit, I probably even there would give maybe a couple of weeks of antibiotics, but there is an argument as to whether that's necessary or not. I suspect you would not.
I would not, but I'm going to throw this one to Mickey. This might be controversial. Is surgical management better?
Yes. From a quiet shunt.
Tell us why.
Well, we're talking about congenital shunt. So, if we're dealing with a dog with a congenital prostate shunt, then overall, for most dogs, then surgery is likely to give a better long-term outcome. So, there was a study in 2014 which prospectively compared a cohort of dogs that had medical management with surgical management, and the dogs that were managed surgically had a longer survival and a subjectively better quality of life. And this was, they had something like 97 dogs with surgery and 28 or something with medical management or something in that region. But I think that it's always worth saying, what I say to owners is that, so if you look at a population, then surgery is likely to give a better outcome because essentially you're treating the problem. Whereas I always think of medical management, it can be very effective, but essentially we're just managing the signs. So we're managing it rather than curing it. So if we can attenuate the shunt, close it, and redirect normal or near normal portal blood flow, and that's likely to result in improved liver function and resolution of clinical signs. Look, clearly we can't do that with medicine. Now, obviously, the main big caveat with that is that surgery isn't without risk, and overall, there's probably a 5% chance of the animal not surviving surgery. And so clearly, the 5% of dogs that do not survive surgery do not have a better outcome than those managed medically. However, we don't have a particularly good way of identifying those animals which will respond well to surgery or might have complications. And therefore, it sort of always sort of just presents the owners with the facts and say, obviously, we can do surgery. There's a, you know, a 5% chance your animal will not survive, but if it does, it's likely to have a better outcome than being managed medically long term. Other potential advantages of surgery is that it does, if it works, then you've sort of solved the problem. You don't have to give ongoing medication. Whereas, you know, although medical management is very safe, there's no chance. Well, that's probably not strictly true, but there's, you know, limited chance of the animal suddenly dying as a result of the medical management. Clearly, they need to be on it lifelong, and they may be vulnerable to flare-ups of hepatic encephalopathy or urinary tract obstruction with time, and obviously that has an effect on their quality of life. Yes, surgical management is better, but not for the dogs that die.
Okay, cool.
What about the cases that have do have microvascular issues or portal hypoplasia and can't cope with the increased flow? Would you expect those to be included in that 5% that don't make it, or do you attenuate and see how it looks intraoperatively?
So what you're alluding to is those animals with have less well-developed livers, so they can't necessarily tolerate complete ligation of the shunt. So when we're doing surgery, since we have two options in terms of the way we manage dogs with and cats with shunts, we can try and ligate them completely, and if they can't tolerate that, then we need to do something else. So we can either historically we would treat them with partial ligation and then potentially repeat surgery two to three months later, during which time the liver's normally develops enough so they can tolerate complete ligation, or we place a gradual attenuation device, so an amyloid constrictor or thin film band. The idea being that with time, that will cause hopefully complete occlusion of the shunt and therefore stop ongoing shunting. And depending on, so amyloids and thin film bands probably have a 25 to 35% persistent shunting, but generally those animals with persistent shunting are still improved. So again, there's a lot of variation in published studies, but probably about 80 to 90% of animals that have surgery, you know, have a reasonable long-term outcome. I think it's a spectrum of disease, so all of these animals have abnormal liver histopathology. They all have some degree of what used to be called microvascular dysplasia or primary portal vein hyperplasia. So, and that probably doesn't resolve. So, sometimes when we have an animal that has a very good recovery, we recognise they still have mildly increased bile acids. And that's probably because they've got some persistent microvascular shunting. But that probably doesn't. That's pretty much all of them, so on vast majority of them, so they will still potentially have a good outcome despite that.
That's a good point, actually. I think that's one of the things that sometimes after animals have had attenuation and have had a good clinical recovery, sometimes there are concerns from our sort of client practices that the bile acids are still elevated, and does this mean we're going to do surgery again, and so on. And very often, if the animal's clinically significantly improved, the answer is probably no. As you say, there will be some residual issues, there may be other reasons to have high bile acids, but we're looking for clinical improvement for every other.
Yes, absolutely. But although that does bring us back to this whole point about how do you actually know whether the problem's resolved or actually just improved. And actually, maybe a lot of these animals have persistent but very mild subclinical signs. So, and we don't have a good answer to that. When we're talking about microvascular dysplasia or primary portal vein hyperplasia, we're talking about animals that have shunting at a microvascular level, so they don't necessarily have a macroscopic shunt. So sometimes they'll might be sort of a differential diagnosis for congenital portostomic shunt. So often these still, it's quite common in terrier breeds, particularly West Yorkies and Cairn terriers, and they will have sort of similar but much more mild signs and biochemical changes to animals with macroscopic shunts. So the management for those animals, of course, is medical because there's no surgery that we can do for them. But the good news is they normally do really well with medical management.
Great. I've got one more question about surgery. What about intrahepatic shunts?
Yes, surgery is recommended for them as well. We've probably got less. There were some intrahepatic shunts included in the prospective medical versus surgical management paper, although it's not very clear how they sort of divided up. So we can treat intrahepatic shunts very similarly to extrahepatic shunts. Essentially, we perform surgery, find the vessel or access the draining hepatic vein or the supplying portal vein branch, and essentially within attenuate in a similar way. So we can ligate it or place a thin film band or an amyloid constrictor. Although I tend to find we've got far less room to try and place an amyloid. So generally a thin film band or a suture ligation is preferable in my hands. But we can operate successfully. We've done several this year. They've gone very well. Big concern with intrahepatic shunts historically is that there is a more significant risk of complications, primarily bleeding, because they are, the very nature of them tends to make them harder to dissect out because they're obviously within the liver, whereas the extrahepatic shunts are sort of generally conveniently placed where you can access them more readily. More recently, people have recommended doing endovascular coiling of intrahepatic shunts. So as opposed to trying to get something around them from the outside, we essentially try and place a thrombogenic coil within the shunt to try and close it from the inside. So this is done under fluoroscopic guidance, and essentially you place catheters down the jugular vein and into the shunt, and then you can deploy the coils to occlude the shunt. And it's much similar to endovascular management of PDAs. The difference is that because the shunt connects directly with the vena cava, you actually need to place a stent in the vena cava to ascend over the mouth of the shunt, to essentially like as a cage or a net to prevent the coils migrating around the rest of the body, which that would be sad. So then the stents are very expensive. So one of the limitations of the coiling procedure is quite expensive. But so essentially, you place a stent in the vena cava, then pass the catheter through the stent into the shunt, and put some coils in, and that will provide some acute closure of the shunt. So the coils themselves will obstruct blood flow, and then hopefully they'll also provide some ongoing closure. Although my experience has been that you don't often get, there's often persistent shunt, there's a relatively high rate of persistent shunting.
Great, thank you. And I know, Mickey, you're very published in this area of congenital portal systemic shunts. What's the study that's starting at Paragon?
Oh, okay, yeah. So our new medicine resident, Ben, he's developed a very interesting study and something we sort of alluded to, I think, looking at essentially the requirement for antibiotics in the medical management of dogs with shunts. So as Adam said, there is some controversy about how important or useful antibiotics are in medical management. And I think, in the current climate, or this day and age, but maybe I shouldn't say that. That sounds a bit different, doesn't it? Due to recent concerns over antimicrobial resistance, I think we probably have to be trying to reduce the amount of antimicrobials we prescribe. And certainly, I think anecdotally, there's some evidence to suggest that we maybe don't need to prescribe antibiotics in the management of hepatic encephalopathy in dogs. And some individual groups and clinicians have been not doing that for a long time without any major incidents. So what we want to do is we want to do a randomized study looking at animals with shunts being managed with diet and lactulose versus diet, lactulose and antibiotics to see if we can tell a difference. And so we're looking to recruit dogs with hepatic encephalopathy and, well, ultimately with congenital porta semi shunts, although I guess when we recruit them, we may not know for certain that they have that, but certainly with high suspicion of that disease. And then obviously trying them with two different treatment modalities. Now, it's important to say, obviously, that many of these animals may go on to have surgery, so it's not an alternative for surgery, but we always will manage dogs with shunts with medically prior to surgery for at least sort of 2 to 3 weeks, because we want to get them as stable as possible prior to surgery. So if anyone is interested or has any cases they think may be suitable, we'd really love to hear from you. Ben is certainly keen to get this started at probably the beginning of next year, so 2021. But you know, if you have a case before then please do get in touch, and we can certainly try and recruit it. That would be great. And see if you've got anyone's got any questions about that, they can get in touch, and that would be super. We'd love to hear from you.
Well, thanks, guys. This has been very helpful. Hope you liked my grilling. I hope that helpful for the people who are going to be listening in. Have a nice rest of the day.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You make me laugh when I was trying to be sensible.